Welcome to another dimension, a dimension of insight, a dimension of understanding. You are entering a place where reality collides with truth. There are no limits, there are no boundaries. This is Off Planet Radio.
Following our guests on and off for as long as they've been around. When I listen to them, I always feel like I'm amongst friends, and we seem to have been walking sort of parallel paths, having different experiences, but always seeming to arrive at about the same place at about the same time. And here we are tonight. They are the creators of Truth Frequency Radio Network and the hosts of Beyond the Veil Radio. I'm so glad to have you two here. Chris and Sheree Geo, welcome to Off Planet Radio.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, welcome, guys.
Cool. So just in case I'm sure a lot of our audience is probably familiar with you guys, but in case they're not, can you guys tell us just a little bit about yourselves and how you got to where you are?
Sure. I was somewhat of a troll on the Prison Planet Forum, not in the traditional sense, but rather I was challenging people to think outside of the box. And Sheree was a moderator there, and she was assigned to keep an eye on me. So...
Well, oh my gosh. Wow.
It wasn't as much like that as it was. I asked the head moderator, because I was just a mod with the eugenics forum, that whole portion with eugenics and mind control and that kind of thing. And that was my area of specialty. And so he's asking about the no planes theory. And so I ask the lead moderator, hey, who is this guy? And he's like, oh, he's probably a troll. You need to keep an eye on him. and then we started talking more and more off air. And we didn't speak to each other for like a year. And then when I came back, because I had some family issues I had to deal with, I had a relative who passed away. So when I came back, it's as if we just picked up right where we left off. And within a month, he was asking me to come see David Icke with him.
Well, I was joking. It was like just a joke. I said, hey, do you want to run off and see David Icke with me? And she lived about 3 hours away. Uh-huh. And David Icke was performing in... Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Yeah.
And she said, yeah, come and pick me up. And I said, no, I can't do that. And she said, no, really, come and pick me up. I went and picked her up, and the rest is history. The natural progression was to just apply the knowledge that we had, start a radio show, and take it from there. We had no idea that it would turn into what it's turned into. It was just a block talk radio show back then. And it's turned into a whole station, 33 hosts, and just absolutely incredible.
It's an amazing dream come true, really, for us.
Awesome. Yeah, you guys.
So, let me ask you this, Chris. Did you have a background before in media at all? In putting a network together like this? It sounds like things just kind of came together over time. But do you have a background in media?
Not really. I have a background in audio engineering. So,
all right, well, that's useful.
I was into music. I was writing hip-hop tracks for a record label down in Dallas. Going way before that, though, I was actually a DJ at a rave DJ. I spun trance and drum and bass and things like that. So I was really heavily involved in the rave scene in the late 90s. So all of this knowledge that I obtained, I started to apply into what we were doing later on down the line. It was just incredible how it all came together. The rave scene, I didn't realize at the time as a DJ that the DJ is actually the shaman and leading the crowd. Had I known back then what I know now, I would have done my sets completely different.
Absolutely. So you just to fill in here the information, you guys kind of started off more like on the sort of truther kind of track and then have evolved over time into more the consciousness and, you know, spirituality and multidimensional layers of everything kind of realm. Yes.
Yeah. And what's funny is I did an album called Global Resistance, and the last track on it is called Consciousness, where the album kind of ends. And then there's like another part that's supposed to come after that. But I really didn't understand what consciousness was at the time. It was only in hindsight that I realized, oh, this is where we're leaving off and then picking up later in another project. It was really funny how it came together. I posted the track We're in a Lot of Trouble. And Michael Tesarian wrote me and said, hey, can I use this in one of my DVDs? And I said, yeah, sure, absolutely. I love your work. I'm a big fan, so on and so forth. And when we started the radio show, we were able to call him up and say, hey, Michael, can you come on our show? We're nobody. We have 10 listeners and that's it. We're on Blog Talk. But can you do us this favor? He said, yeah, absolutely. And then he introduced us to his audience and it just kind of blew up from there.
Yeah, and then you guys went down the slippery slope of other radio networks and all that kind of jazz before deciding you just needed to do your own thing, yeah?
Learning experiences.
There was a learning curve to this, for sure. There were some encounters with some people that were less than reputable. But when you get into this, you know, with a pure heart, you think that everybody else is like that too. And you think, wow, you know, I'm in the truth movement. I'm going to make a change. I'm going to start, you know, just networking with all these different people. And at least in our experience, we really didn't have the discernment going into it. And then it hit me like 2 years later, like, you know, it's the truth movement. Of course, it's going to be the most infiltrated group in existence. Yep. Like, why would it not be? It took a couple of years for me to realize that.
Well, and not only that, but we get into this thinking that there's no ego because we're all looking for the truth. We're just looking for the truth. And so, oh, okay, great. No ego. But then as soon as you step into it, even just half a step in, you realize, oh, there's ego everywhere in here. And so we had to kind of shelter ourselves for a little bit to kind of regroup. And eventually we just started our own radio network.
But then the consciousness aspect of it came in when we realized that this was kind of the next logical progression in the quest for truth, because you can understand that the government's corrupt. You can understand that they're setting up FEMA camps and so on and so forth. But when you take it to the next level and really understand why they're doing all of this, you realize that as a humanity, we have a soul and the soul is very, very sick. And this is really the undertone as to why we're seeing so much hate, death, chaos, destruction, so on and so forth. So naturally, we want to try to heal that. And I've realized as time progressed that we've got a lot of brothers and sisters here, and they're all star seeds. They've all come from another place, higher dimension, I would say. We've come down here to help the world ascend, and we're all coming together now in 2017. I mean, it's just absolutely beautiful. I would go so far as to say that the Donald Trump situation is a marker of a new timeline that we were able to actually shift as all of us, you know, all of the light workers here did their work, shifted it into this new timeline. Now we have to maintain it. Not saying that Donald Trump is the best thing since sliced bread or even a positive entity. However, just it's a marker to show that the old power structure has been dissolved. The old timeline has been dissolved. The Clinton regime has been taken out of office. And now we have a new path in front of us.
I just had that same identical conversation with a friend of mine about a half an hour ago.
Did you?
And No, and you know, the interesting thing is we know that something changed on election night, you know, and it was almost surreal in a lot of ways because it was so unexpected. But at the same time, I think what happened there was a dynamic kicked in that is giving us a space right now to work in a way we couldn't have worked had it gone the other way. It doesn't have anything to do with the front end personalities. Mm-hmm. It has to do with the energetic that's going on in the background of the political machine. Political machine is just a mechanism. It's a front end mechanism. What's driving it is consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know, so like this whole consciousness thing is huge, and it's a process that you go through to get to where you start to understand how that operates.
Absolutely. Go ahead,
Trey. No, go ahead. I was going to say one more thing. It seems like as a society, as a culture or as a people in general, we're moving towards something. And whether that something is this giant backlash that you see against, you know, the whole Clinton Crime Family Foundation or the Pizzagate and things like that, what they want is a huge backlash. When Donald Trump was running for office, they wanted us to think, oh, he's never going to get an office. Oh, he's a loser. He's this, he's that. And people might even agree with them on the surface and say, oh, yeah, yeah, Trump's an asshole. But then, you know, they silently walk into the ballot box and they vote for him anyway, because they know deep down inside that's what's better. And so it was like this huge, it's this huge undercurrent of change that we're trying to bring about. And at the same time, if we have too much change or if we get too hostile or too aggressive with this, then it'll backfire, because the Hegelian dialectic actually prescribes that we have a huge backlash that is required in order for them to bring in the FEMA camps and bring in the martial law and all of that. But if we stay calm, if we keep doing what we're doing, we're going to win this.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And I meant to bring this up as something I wanted to talk about, but I'll just lay it here. I think we're at this spot where lots of people have been doing lots of work in the background. We're all amongst them. And now sort of, it's kind of like the 3% thing, right, with the American Revolution. There's some of us who've been toiling hard in the background. And actually something that kind of the three of you, and me to a certain extent, we all have in common, is having really taken ourselves from a point A very far along to a point B, all having broken certain kinds of programming. Cherie, I know you come from a very religious background. Your father was a pastor, correct?
Oh, and grandfather.
Grandfather. Yeah. And Randy was in Christian radio. He comes from a very Christian family as well, was in Christian radio for a number of years. And then, you know, also, I think you both, from what I understand about your background, Chris, a little bit, you know, came from a period of time where you were into the whole kind of patriot sort of movement. Yeah. And Randy was into that as well. And then all of us have also, and this is a big thing, even though we all are interested in the truth, we've all broken truther programming, because that's a mind control program too. And so we've come this really, really, like, we've done all this work here, and now there's people starting, you can see it, even the people who are arguing, like, about the Donald Trump, the Hillary Clinton, and all the social justice nonsense and all this kind of stuff, you know, those people who want to protest, and they still don't quite understand that that's exactly what they want. They want all these massive protests. But I'm starting to see a few little gems pop up and go, hey, wait a second. Look at this here. This doesn't make any sense. This thing that the liberals are talking about, that's not very liberal. Wait a second. All right. It's not what they've been saying it is on TV. It's actually something else. It might be better or it might be worse than what they're saying, but it isn't what they're talking about. There's something else going on here. So I'm starting to see people who you would never have suspected start to catch on to a little something. And I think it is, in some ways, a culmination of the work that people have been doing in the background to break massive amounts of programming all this time, that now people, that, you know, everyone else, kind of, you know, the more general public is having the opportunity to do it without, they don't need to know all about all this stuff we know about. You know what I mean? There's not time for that. What do you guys think about that? I mean, about the idea of having broken out of all this, you know, like breaking out of one programming to the next, but I think that, you know, we're kind of, we've reached past that final layer here. What do you think?
I think you're absolutely spot on, and I can take it an even step further. The John Birch Society preaches the 1776 closed border, so on and so forth. My analysis of the New World Order is that they want one entity controlling several different factions in prison cities where everybody's locked in, you can't move around, you can't do all of that. The thing that they fear the most is unity. So what people like the John Birch Society have done is pushed people or programmed people into moving back into that close the borders, build a wall, so on and so forth kind of mentality, when in actual fact, they're moving more towards the new world order that they want, which is one entity controlling everybody. When in actual fact, we should be tearing down borders, we should be uniting together and realizing that they see us versus them. They don't see black, white, Christian, Muslim, so on and so forth. And we need to start seeing on the same dynamic. That's the only way that we're going to be on an even playing field. But as long as they keep us divided, that's exactly where they want us. And part of the truther programming, and I like the way you frame that, and a lot of people, I can see them getting upset over this kind of dialogue and this kind of lingo, but really they have to realize that this is just another box that they've been put into. Now, it's a box outside of the standard box, but there's still many more boxes. And we always have to constantly question, our belief systems, our BS, have they put us in another box? And if so, how do we break out of it?
Well, and I think Randy could agree with me that Christian radio is a whole different animal than regular radio. I think I actually remember listening to your voice at some point, Randy. I think that's why your voice sounds familiar to me. But I remember when growing up that if any kind of outside idea tried to wiggle its way in, it would result in just utter chaos in the minds of the people around me. And I never could understand why. You know, why is Clinton being talked about so much in 1996 when, you know, I'm 13 years old and I'm thinking to myself, okay, what, you know, what is all of this? And so I can completely understand how the Christian programming, even if broken, could just lead straight to the truther programming, which can't be broken if you're still kind of already in the Christian programming. It's an overlap that binds you in.
The Christian Patriot Movement was interesting for a while because these were people who were basically espousing a faith that was based on individual freedom, but it actually became its own walled city after a while as well. And then obviously what you had in the 1990s, you had the Montana Freemen, you had Waco, you had Ruby Ridge. You had all of these scary scenarios which were hits against the Patriot Movement, all Christian. I mean, you could argue about what David Koresh represented, but that was a religious community. And so there was a backlash to all of that. And the scary part was watching now as it was Bibles, bullets, and survival food, which fed this whole industry that then became this Patriot radio juggernaut that Alex Jones came from. I was on networks that Alex Jones was on when he was coming up. And, you know, I think he did a good job. I think he's put a message out there. But I've also told people over the years, you got to think about what Alex Jones doesn't talk about and the things that he's saying that are galvanizing a hardcore in this country that was obviously going to lead us to a place where we were going to wind up being in a shooting gallery. And the Christian side of it was, it's schismatic. It's always been schismatic. You introduce one idea that they consider heretical, and you're tarred and feathered. Well, that happened to me about a half dozen times. I mean, I was a complete radical. I got to the point where the second year on short, I walked on to shortwave radio talking about Zionism. Not a popular subject at the time. Mm-hmm. Talking about what was going on in Palestine and Gaza, and what the Zionist agenda was. And as you can imagine, there was a lot of backlash. So my message by the second year was basically, get the hell out of your churches. They're apostate. The spirit's not allowed to move there anymore. 5 years down the road, I'm like, you know, I'm reading this Bible now and I'm going, this Yahweh guy, he isn't looking good to me. There's a lot of sacrifice and blood and war going on. You know where I'm going? And I know you do because I took some time to listen to a couple of your shows, Chris, the one that you did on Luciferian, Christ Consciousness.
Oh, they strung me up and nailed me to a cross for that.
Oh, yeah. I sat by the whole time crying like Mary. You know, it was awful.
it's truthful. I mean, when you break out of the programming, when you break out of the religious programming,
yeah,
you get down to the spirit, you start, the way that I like to look at the world is a very simple standard of good versus evil. Good is anything that preserves life and preserves freedom. Evil is anything that impedes upon life and impedes upon freedom. I think 99.999% of sentient beings can agree upon that standard.
Yeah.
So when you apply this standard to this Yahweh character, you realize, hey, wait a minute, there's something seriously wrong here. This is a character that has indiscriminately killed the entire world. I mean, if you read the Bible, he flooded the whole world.
He's literally
sociopath,
right?
If you look at his actions from the Old Testament.
That's not to discount the ideas that Jesus brought to the table. Because he talked about love, he talked about unity, he talked about consciousness. Right, yeah. And if you look at the Gnostic versions of the Jesus character, He was a mystic. He was exactly like what we're doing right now, just trying to elevate the consciousness and trying to get people to love one another. And I'm starting to hear in the Christian circles now, I was just listening to a radio show on TFR that's Christian based, and the guest said, "Hey, you know what? I think this Yahweh guy is not who we think he is." And I thought, finally, they're starting to get it now. It's about love and nothing more.
You know, it's so hard to get out of that paradigm. And, you know, just briefly, I know we haven't gotten into the psychedelics yet, but I had a psychedelic experience where I was shown crosses. And I think, you know, maybe you guys can chime in on this later on in the broadcast too, but I saw crosses and I thought, okay, well, crosses mean Jesus and I don't see Jesus anywhere. So where's God? Where's the God of the Bible? And then suddenly I was lowered into this pit, like really quick, like I fell into a pit and this bright light comes down on me. And it wasn't a white light of beauty and love or anything like that. This was like a 10-year-old dousing a slug with salt. That's what it felt like. That was blinding me. And I was like, stop. And it just kept hitting me over and over again from every direction. And it almost drove me insane. That was the only psychedelic experience that I've ever asked to meet Yahweh face to face. And it's the last one I will ever do too.
Wow. That's interesting.
Well, yeah. It is really interesting how, though, what I'm starting to notice is what the psychedelics do is just show you your programming. Whether it was direct kind of forms of mind control, like I was telling you about, or whether it's these things that are supposedly Christian, patriot, truth, good, whatever, it shows you your programming. You know what I mean? And so it's an opportunity to either be further programmed by it or to go, wait a second. I see the structure of this. Let's start breaking it down and see what happens then. So we'll get back to psychedelics in a little bit, but I'm glad you shared that story there. So, okay, so breaking these kinds of programming, then we move into a truth movement, and you know we get into things like 9/11 is an inside job, and even the truthers who can mostly agree about that, then they're fighting about planes, no planes, were there bombs in the building, was it directed energy weapons, was it nuclear, whatever, right? Or on and on with any kind of, the chemtrails. Is it, is it the metal and barium? Is it microprocessors in there? Everyone, we're all agreeing there's something there, but everyone's kind of divided in their groups, just like you said. But over this period of time, people have become wiser. So they've had to become more creative in the things that they present us, which kind of moves us to what's been going on the last couple of years, and that is the flat earth and then the Mandela effect. And you guys, of all the people who've really talked about it extensively and done work on it, I like the way you guys deal with it the best. Me and Randy talk about this sometimes. We really enjoyed the exercise. That's what we see it as, of what the flat earth thing represented. So can you tell me, I know you were really into it for a little while. What did you think when you saw this coming? Did you feel like you kind of fell into some of that programming before and then worked your way out of it? Or did you always sort of see it as what it was, an exercise to sort of understand that, we're not dealing with an either or thing, we're dealing with sort of both and kind of thing. Tell me about your experience with the flat earth.
Well, that was the second time I got nailed to a cross and crucified. When I started talking about that, people went nuts. And it was very indicative, in my opinion, as to where people really are. Because if you're really seeking the truth, then you're going to seek it wherever it leads you, and you're going to follow it wherever the truth leads you. And when I first presented the idea, the people closest around to me, the way that they reacted, I don't need to look into this, you're stupid, you're this and that, which is the natural reaction for everybody. A friend of mine came to me about a year before that, and he said, I've been looking into this flat earth theory, and I think there's some legitimacy to it. And I looked at Cherie and I said, he's lost his mind. It was just, I had the same knee-jerk reaction to it. So everybody does have the same knee-jerk reaction to it.
And it sounds ridiculous. It sounds,
It sounds like a trap. It sounds like they want to paint people as flat earthers and so on and so forth. Right. But then when you start to lift the veil and go beyond it, you start to go, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense about the globe theory. This doesn't make sense. This, wait, are you telling me that all the photos from NASA are fake? They're satellite composites. Is that really what I've been looking at this entire time? And it's just all apart.
And it's pretty much the same composite. There aren't even that many different ones. It's pretty much we've been looking at the same one over and over again.
Right. And the land, I mean, even Mr. Blue Marble, I forget what his name is, but he did an interview and he said, my job is to take all the satellite images and they're all flat images and turn them into a sphere and make them look the way people expect it to look.
Right.
I mean, this is not even trying to hide it. They're like, this is what we do and this is what we've been doing. So, but to me, what that did is that allowed me to open up my mind enough to now, am I not only questioning the government and am I not only questioning religion, but now I'm questioning this entire reality, which has broken so many boundaries and allowed me to think in an even deeper and bigger dynamic. And I think that's what the flat earth is ultimately the most useful for. And a lot of people will stop there and it's perfectly fine. If you don't want to go, you know, past that boundary, then you've already set up where your truth ends and that's fine. But ultimately, the conclusion that I've come to is that, I mean, I guess, you know, saying it just right out, and it sounds a little bit crazy, but we're living in a computer simulated hologram, essentially. And you have, the way a hologram works is there's a three-dimensional image projected on a two-dimensional surface. So some people see the three-dimensional image and think it's real. Some people see the flat surface and think it's real, but ultimately it's all a simulation. There was a guy named Professor Gates, and he's a quantum physicist, and he found a computer code written in the fabric of space-time. Now, it's not just any computer code. It's a computer code based on a guy's code named Claude Shannon.
The French guy, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Why are they finding his computer code? Computer code is pretty extensive. Like, I write computer code for a living, and it's not just like a couple of words or a couple of symbols. This is like a long code inside.
This is like a computer checksum, right? Is this not?
Yeah,
it's basically.
It's an entire language. It's a self-correcting code that they found in the fabric of reality. So why is this guy's code in reality? This has to be a hologram. The question is, when were we injected into this simulation and why? Maybe Spiro came in 2012 and this is the afterlife, or maybe this is our consciousness was injected by some kind of extraterrestrials that are moving us to another planet. I mean, there's so many different ways you can think about this, and it just opens up so many doors of possibility. But we'll never find out the reason why. But we do see that there's something really going on in reality that is not correct. And then we have Mandela effect and so on and so forth. But let me say this really quick. Understanding that this is a computer program then allows you to change reality and manipulate it in your particular sphere the way that you want. Manifesting reality suddenly.
You just said sphere. It's not a sphere. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, reality is a sphere. My own sphere here.
You ball licker. What are you talking about?
Oh, you know, that's another.
Are you a baller?
The way that everybody is fighting with one another.
I know. This is insane.
We lost all manners, all interaction, social skills with each other. It's like, what happened
here? It became cults, warring cults, the whole thing. Flat earthers were just hating on ball earthers, and ball earthers are going, you people were morons. And I watched all these YouTube, and for a while, I was like, oh my God, these people were declaring war over the shape of their world? Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we put out a video called Believers and Truth Seekers. And in that video, we made the point that a colorblind person isn't working with the same data set as somebody who can see colors. Who's right? Who's wrong? Who's stupid? Who's crazy? Nobody. It's all really just a matter of perspective. But we made it so ambiguous that we had ball earthers and flat earthers calling us shills simultaneously in the comment section. It was hilarious.
That's exactly like I just made a I made a comment on a page that I'm a private group on Facebook that I'm a member of that looks at cloaked cloud craft. Mm-hmm. And I just like someone had a picture of the moon and they were talking about how the moon feels closer than it used to. And I was like, yeah, you know what? I've kind of always, for many years now, I've thought the moon is maybe 80 to 200 miles away. And now I think it might even be closer. I said, it feels like they're lowering the ceiling or something. And somebody in the group took that to mean that I was saying that we have a flat earth and that there's a dome. And it wasn't even what I was thinking about, right? And so he started a whole shitstorm that got people kicked out of the group. Like, I had nothing to do with it. I wasn't even there for the argument. But literally, people were, like, this guy, one guy was, like, losing his mind over this. And I'm like, look. He sent me a note asking me, so who's a flat earther here? I was like, I have no idea who. I was like, I'm not a flat earther or a ball earther. To me, it's not an either or question. It's a both and thing. I feel like what you were kind of saying, like there's the disc and there's sort of the sphere. And then I think we're also dealing with the toroidal sort of like energy flowing, like, you know, vortex kind of thing. Right. Mm-hmm. So I feel like how you see it is dependent on sort of where you're at with your consciousness in any given moment.
And, exactly.
And also the energetics and the magnetics of what's going on around you. Like, we have a very, you know, strange changing energy field around us all the time. I don't think it is a consistent thing. The one thing that I will say, and this is just another way of sort of saying what you were about simulation, is we are living in some kind of construct for sure. Right. Mm-hmm. So we're living in something that is not like, it's not, we weren't just here, like all of a sudden, this is something that we have been somehow placed into, or something that has been overlaid on us. I remember listening to one of your, and this was a couple, maybe like a year back, maybe even longer, Sheree, you were talking about on one of your experiences that you were shown, like, that the earth was like in like a blanket or like a pea pod, and that the ayahuasca goddess or whatever was telling you that it was, that we were moved, like that it was flat and round, that we were moved from one to the other to protect us. Do you remember that? Can you tell us what you were talking about there?
You know what? That was such a powerful experience, that when you have a powerful psychedelic experience, especially with ayahuasca or DMT, because it's the spirit molecule, it's what comes out when you dream. It's very difficult to remember the strongest ones. But I will say that growing up as the daughter/granddaughter of a pastor, I learned sociology very early on. And I also learned how people manipulate other people. And as I got older, naturally, I went into sociology when I went to college. And I learned in sociology about group theory and things like that. And so I kind of applied group theory to the flat earth theory and the round earth theory and the holographic reality theory.
Yeah.
And to me, it seems like it is a matter of perspective, but it's also a matter of your environment. If your environment is all telling you you're an idiot for believing this, then eventually you'll come around to thinking that you were an idiot for a while and go back to believing in the round earth. If you are surrounded by flat earth people, then that's bad too, because then you're never going to be able to get to that holographic reality part.
Yeah.
So, yes, it is programming to a certain extent. And that was my first thought when all of this started to come out and Chris started to become a flat earther. I was like, okay, well, wait a second. Hold on.
She said, you're not actually going to talk about this on the show, are you?
Well, the only reason I did that was because I understood sociologically that you say one thing and then you immediately isolate that other 50%. You say another thing, you immediately isolate the other 50%. So my choice was to kind of go straight down the middle with it. Like, I don't know. I do know that something's wrong here, but I don't know what it is. And I think that's the safest place to be. And that's kind of how you're a slider. You slide through and you get into what it really is, which it is both flat and round. Yep. It's according to your perspective, whether your optical lens is zooming in a certain way or not, and what we're really seeing is a construct.
I had a vision, because I've asked this question many times in the ayahuasca experiences, if it's flat or if it's round, what is this construct? And it doesn't quite line up with what I necessarily feel at this particular moment. But back then, what I was shown was two spheres, and the mother goddess was standing there or sitting off in the background, and this other sphere came and hit this other sphere, and she wailed out the most horrible cry, only like a mother losing her child. I mean, it was a horrible cry. And she went and she grabbed whatever she could and put a dome on top of it, like a protective dome. And that's what she showed me there. So I don't know, maybe there's some truth to that maybe our planet, something happened to it, and we had to be quarantined or protected, or quarantine's not the right word, but isolated under.
It may actually be the right word. What you just described there sounds a lot to me like the Tiamat scenario.
Right, right.
You know, we have this asteroid belt that sits out there, and it's not accounted for, but there is a certain symmetry of the array of the planets as we know them. Or what? When you start talking about space, you forget talking about Earth. Emily and I talk about space, and we're like, is there space? You know, and this is based even on talking to people who have been in secret space programs. But if we just take what we've literally been shown, we know the asteroid belt's out there. And the legends are that there was a planet that sat out there called Tiamat, which was destroyed as part of a cosmic war. And that, in fact, that impacted this planet. Velikovsky wrote about cataclysmic events that hit the Earth based on the Bible. Other writers have theorized on passbys of Mars, which would have created these gigantic swells in the planet as a result of the gravitational fields interacting. We don't know. But I do think that somewhere inside of the collective consciousness of the planet, which is reflected in us because we're children of it, there's a traumatic event that sits there. It's like a wound that we never healed. So when you were saying that was kind of the picture I was getting of that.
I've heard that story before. I haven't looked into it too much, but I am familiar with that. There may be some truth to that. The only thing that I can't get over is the fact that reality seems to have changed sometime around 2008 to 2012. For me, anyways, that seemed to be a marker. When I first met Cherie, we were filling up our water bottles at this reverse osmosis place around the corner from my house. And we had just been there about a week prior, 2 weeks prior. And it was gone. The building was gone. Yeah. It didn't exist.
Even the pumping stations that you would use to fill up the water bottles, all the plumbing was gone. You don't get rid of plumbing overnight like that. That doesn't happen.
Right. So we started asking different guests, just kind of in passing, hey, you ever notice any weird anomalies with reality? And it sounds, you know, crazy just right off the cuff, but some people started responding, saying, you know, I remember these changes. And then the Mandela effect became a term. Obviously, we had nothing to do with coining the term, but other people started coming forward and saying, hey, I remember this reality. I remember this reality. And we started to unlock like these, all these mysteries of what's going on with the time shifts. Frank Castle, one of our friends, came over to the house one time and he was looking for a hotel. Well, we just had a big, like three or four different hotels, maybe more, just spring up overnight one night. And I said, you know, Frank, there's a bunch of hotels here. And he said, I can't find any record of any hotels around your house. I said, well, don't worry about it. Just come stay at the house. So I showed him the hotels when we were there. There was a Denny's in the parking lot. We went in and Frank asked one of the waitresses, hey, when did these hotels show up? And she goes, I don't know. They just popped up overnight one night. So other people were starting to notice it as well.
I've had experiences like that my whole life, but I was trying to, this was several years back. This was before any of this Mandela effect stuff was talked about. I was trying to explain to my friend the sort of parallel realities, you know, like possible wormholes, different things like that. And I said, look, have you had the experience? And this is a person who doesn't buy into a lot of that stuff. But I said, look, have you had the experience before where, like there's a little shopping center and there's a store you like in it and you go back there, you found it one time and like, oh, you bought a bunch of cool stuff there and you go back and not only is the store not there, but nobody knows what the heck you're talking about. She's like, yeah. I'm like, that's it right there. And so almost everybody, you can get them to submit to at least one of those. I've been having stuff like that my whole life. I mean, I've been having all sorts of kooky stuff, freeway exits, like rest stops disappearing, coming back. Like I had a weird one this summer where like, so for many, many, many years, I've been having this memory of like an exit off of a freeway when I'm traveling places. And I've traveled the same roads many times in my life, going across the country, going back and forth between California to Texas. I've always been looking for this exit that I remember, and I've never been able to find it. Well, all of a sudden, this summer, in October, I went on a road trip to Utah and Colorado, which is places that I've really never been. And I'm in Utah the first day, and I'm driving down. I got off to go to my hotel, and I'm driving down the street. I'm like, holy fuck, this is a place. this is it. But I've never been there before. Right? So like, what is that? Right? Mm-hmm. So I've been having these kinds of things my whole life, but people, you can usually get them to cop to one of those little experiences, like what you were saying. Yeah. So some people are starting to refer to these things as like personal Mandela effects. You know what I mean? Like where it's just like something to, which I kind of like that term. I experience some of those every day. You know what I mean? It was funny when the Mandela, I've been experiencing that forever. Mandela effect comes along. And like, I guess the first one that I heard people talking about where like it was a big thing was the Bernstein Bears. And I was like, oh yeah, well this kind of stuff happens all the time. I had something happen to me like the week before with, what's his name? Owen Wilson, you know, the actor Owen Wilson. Mm-hmm. So I was like coming back from Austin and I was, you know, when you're in the airport and you're on the like flat escalators, the walk-a-later things, and there's an ad for a new movie with Owen Wilson on it. And I'm like, wait a second, didn't Owen Wilson die a few years ago? And there he is on the thing. So someplace where I was at one point, I remember seeing on the cover of People magazine that Owen Wilson was dead. So I had that experience. And then like a week later is the Berenstain Bears thing. And then it seems to have just like snowballed from there. You guys have done some really, I love that one video you guys did a few weeks back with the 5 Mandela effects proofs. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that and sort of kind of your take on this whole thing?
Well, let me say this first of all. I remember back in 2005, 2006, picking up a Berenstain Bears book and thinking, this must be some cheap knockoff. And I didn't even think anything of it at the time because I saw it spelled Berenstain. And that was just my first instinct. Like, this is a cheap knockoff. But that one is the most interesting, in my opinion, because the trademark attorney has called it Berenstain in several different places. Now, if the trademark attorney isn't going to get it right, that's what he does for a living. He gets things exactly right when it comes to names and whatnot.
His whole job.
Yeah, so you find evidence after evidence after evidence. There's another 80scartoons.net where up until, I want to say, 2002, 2003, I don't remember the date, it was called Berenstain Bears. And you had the entire episode list right there on that website, Berenstain Bears, and all of a sudden it just changes over to Berenstain.
They were Jewish and then they weren't, right?
Yeah. The whole time, you know what happens. So there's another interesting one, though, and these are the most fascinating, the ones that change and then change back. Houston, we have a problem in the film Apollo 13. That was Houston, we've had a problem. It changed to Houston, we've had a problem for a period of time. And then it changed back to Houston, we have a problem. And you can go back to the YouTube videos and read the comments. And some people are like, hey, wait a minute. I remember it being Houston, we have a problem. Mm-hmm. But it's Houston, we have a problem in the video now. But you go back to the original audio from Apollo 13. And now they don't say Houston, we have a problem. They say Houston, we've had a problem. In the original Apollo 13 audio. So I don't know what the heck is going on there.
Go ahead.
One after another. Luke, I am your father. That's the way that Earl Jones remembers it. He said it many times before.
Well, and you know, people that are looking at the Berenstain Bears, obviously they could say, well, it was 25 years ago when you read that book. That you don't, there's no way you can remember reading that when you were six and remembering the right spelling. I mean, that's stupid. But I worked at a library from the time I was 12 to the time I was 22. For 10 years, I worked at a library as a children's librarian. I know it said Berenstain Bears.
Yeah.
I know how to spell. I know how. Yeah. I know what books that I would give to children, and I know that it said Berenstain Bears. And I even showed my grandmother, and she's a pastor's wife. She takes a look at it and goes, oh, that's weird. But then within 30 minutes, I show it to her again, and she said, well, it looks kind of right. And I started wondering, okay, well, I wonder if only people that are really looking for it actually find it, whereas the people that don't want to find it and don't want to have anything change about their reality, they don't want to make anything better or worse or anything. They don't want to change anything. They just want, you know, solid. They'll trick themselves into believing that there hasn't been a Mandela effect when there actually has.
Well, here's another interesting one. People remember an island off the coast of Australia, to the west of Australia. And some people say it's New Zealand. And then you can find remnants like in Dazed and Confused, where they're spinning the globe and you see this island. Well, a couple of weeks ago, we had a guest on. I don't remember who it was. We weren't even talking about Mandela Effect. And he started talking about this ancient island off the coast of Australia that you can still find with satellite images, but it's just underwater now. And I stopped him and I said, wait a minute, what's the name of this island? And I wrote it down and I was looking it up, trying to find more information about this island. But the guest just comes out of nowhere and says, there was an island right there, but it's an ancient island.
Yeah.
So why do we have remnants on modern maps of ancient islands? And then now people have memories of this ancient island that existed that never really actually existed, supposedly.
So have you guys heard of, so I have a couple things to say about all this. Have you guys heard of like the theory of timeline wars and that there's been people kind of coming in and cutting out pieces, there's been some kind of catastrophic kinds of things happening, whether it be from, you know, interdimensional technologies that have been screwing with us and whatever, but there's people who are basically coming in and like almost like editing timelines, right? And they're something got fucked up and they're trying to fix it and put it back, but they put it back wrong, right? And then maybe they later go back and correct it. Like, to me, like, I think that's a possibility. I think there's the possibility of we're just dealing with a bunch of parallel realities, and that there's some people, and I'd say people like us, who have developed the ability to move between them. And so we have memories of this other one. We see this one now. Later we see something else. Like, for my dad, everything is always how it was. Like, you know what I mean? He does. There was one the other day that he was like, "Huh, that's funny," but he just thought that, you know, he can't accept that, like, that's a reality for someone. He thinks they're just remembering wrong. You know, he's a super, super duper duper smart guy, you know? But, like, so I think that, like, the more open you are to that things aren't constant, like, the more you're kind of, you know, there's some people who it's either this or that. It might have changed once, but you're noticing it changed back. It changed a little. There's a comment on this about the fact that you're finding all these intricacies within. You're moving between all these. There's realities within the reality where it's changed a little bit. And because you're so free, you know, and I find myself this way as well, to sort of, I understand that that's how this works. I don't think we're living in a constant thing, that we're having a different experience of it.
Right. And what's interesting about this particular phenomenon is that there's people from different timelines. So the people that don't remember Berenstein, they legitimately do not remember Berenstein because it didn't exist in their timeline. The people that remember Berenstein, so on and so forth. It would be interesting to ask your father about Lucy. We have some explaining to do, because that doesn't exist in this
Lucy,
timeline.
Lucy, you have some explaining to do.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. I don't know.
You got some splaining to do.
Doesn't exist anymore. Never happened.
Never happened.
Well, the interesting one that came up just about a week or two. So I monitor different groups and boards that are talking about it. A couple, one or two that you're in as well, because that's where I saw your video and whatnot. And so the one that came up the other day that was like the easiest one for me to sort of run on tests on people with without freaking them out or getting them pissed off or whatever was the whole Franklin Delano thing. So there's the Delano and the Delanor. And I'm like, what the fuck, Delanor? It's not Delano. It's Delano and his wife is Eleanor, right? Mm-hmm. But there's people who are swearing it's Delanor. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to test this out. I'm going to like pick someone who I totally like and who like is not like us, but is open to all the things that I talk about, and she's totally cool. And I'm just gonna like out of the blue, without any setup, to ask her. Be like, what was Franklin Roosevelt's middle name? She's like Delanor. And I was like, what the fuck? Because I had that moment where like I was like, so okay, so are we from different places? Like I just had that thought in my head, and I'm like, wow, that's interesting. I was like, wow. I said, because where I come from, she doesn't know anything about this. So where I come from, it's Franklin Delano. And she looked at me like the same way I looked at her. But think about this. If we're dealing with like multiple realities, right? Multiple parallel timelines and things like that, it would make perfect sense that one that was just slightly off of ours, where we remember it as Delano and Eleanor, that in a slightly different one, almost everything would be the same, but it would be Delanor and his wife would be Ellen or Eileen or something like that, right? And there'd be very small variations, unlimited amounts of these over and over and over and over. And I think one of the things that's happening right now, would call it shifting in consciousness or the paradigm breaking down, but realities are starting to merge. And that's part of also why there's so much like chaos and why people are wearing vaginas on their heads and yelling and screaming about things that don't make sense. And right. What do you think about that?
It is
like they're shedding tears in mass. Sorry.
I have a theory for you. I don't mean to switch the subject. It's still kind of on this subject. Have you heard of the Donald Trump time travel theory?
So I heard that.
Yes.
Wasn't Kev Baker talking about that last week or something like that?
Oh, was he talking about that? Okay. We started making a video on it, but we never got around to finishing it because of the project came up. But his uncle is John Trump. John Trump was given Nikola Tesla's research. And he basically told the government, no, there's nothing here. But I wonder if he kept the research for himself. And now Trump has been going back and forth trying to fix the timeline. It's a crazy
thing. Well, Randy, tell them about your post. Tell them about your post that got everybody pooping in their pants. The one with the observer.
Oh yeah, we found one of the observers from Fringe in live footage that Fox shot as Trump and his son and Melania were walking down Pennsylvania Avenue after the inaugural address, and we face matched it, and so we have September, who was one of the observers in the Fringe TV series, standing there beside Donald Trump.
Did you guys ever watch Fringe?
No.
Okay. Oh my God. Okay. Well, okay. That's, you guys need to watch that. I would love to have you guys watch that, and then we could go down a whole rabbit hole about that.
Okay.
Basically, in Fringe, they're dealing with a situation where there's colliding universes and people are like, it's basically, Fringe is exactly accurate as to what's going on right now. Everything that can be tried is being tried. There's all sorts of crazy experiments going on, mind control, genetic chimera stuff, parallel timelines, crossing into other universes, time travel, anything you can think about, they're doing, right? So the observers are basically people, like a group of scientists sent back from the future to observe what's going on now, because they've destroyed their environment in the future, and they're coming back to try and basically sort of, you know,
mend it.
In their mind, what they're trying to do is sort of steal the future from the people who still have an organic Earth. Okay, but what it really is humans in the future who have become so obsessed with technology and so technologically advanced that they put tech into themselves, and it basically they became very, very intelligent and logical, but lost all of their humanity. And if you look at them, they actually look like the middle step between people and grays, right? Like that's what the observers look like. So this group traveled back, and a few of them started to, you know, get a little romantic about humanity, and so sort of started trying to help them. You have to watch Fringe. It's the best. Like, it is what is happening. It is you will find so many good nuggets in there. You will love it. But basically, they're these bald guys. They're all bald, and when they first start the Fringe series, they're having all these weird things happen in all of these scenes. There's these bald guys that all look the same, and then they go back and they find them throughout history, showing up at important events. This is it. So this is September, the black and white on the right, and that's the guy. Look at that.
Interesting.
That is not Photoshop.
So Randy made this
fake arm. What's up with the fake arms?
What was that, Chris?
The fake arms. I noticed this guy, but it was a different fake arms.
Yeah, this is both of the security guards to the right and left of Trump are also wearing fake hands, which I think are covering some kind of weapon.
Oh. Interesting.
But you guys understand
that I did this as satire.
Yeah, people freaked out.
A lot of people out.
They thought that he was saying that now everything is fine because the timeline has been corrected and Donald Trump is president. He has people like everybody's so taking everything as a Trump versus Hillary thing that they were missing the irony of like what's going on here. We have now fiction becoming complete reality. The other cool thing about here, show them that picture. The other cool, really interesting thing about Fringe, there's tons of them, but one of my favorites. This is David Robert Jones. Okay, he's in the first season and a half of Fringe, he was jumping, like time traveling and jumping back and forth between universes and creating holes in the universes, basically. So David Bowie's real name is David Robert Jones. And when David Bowie, look at David Bowie. And I was like, when David Bowie died, I'm like, wait a second. That's when
there's scenes in Fringe where David Robert Jones has his face wrapped in a mummy wrap that looks exactly like the Lazarus video that David Bowie did
right before he allegedly left Earth. So David Robert Jones's face was falling apart from like disassembling and reassembling from time travel and all that kind of stuff. And he had, at the end, he has this like white bandage around, and that's what David Bowie has. And I'm like, wait a second. look at all the things David Bowie does. And he looks crazy sometimes. Like, he looked always different. Sometimes he looked like a space alien. Sometimes he looked like some kind of weird zoo animal, right? Like, wait a second. What if he was kind of, if you think about all the things he said, the names of his song, he's the man that fell to earth, he's the man that sold the world. Wait a second. What if he traveled into the future and sold us into the position that we're in now, right? So when that happened, when David Bowie died and I found out his name was David Robert Jones, I was like, what is going on here? There's so many of those things in Fringe. Check it out. You guys will really like it.
We'll have to check that out.
We have to check it out now.
I have to mention here that Terrence McKenna said that what would happen once he didn't know at first. He said it's kind of like, because people would ask him, what's going to happen in 2012? Because he had this theory, and he called it the time wave theory. Yeah. And I'm sorry. And he said, you know, it's really hard to tell because it's kind of like asking someone at 4 a.m. what sunrise going to look like. We don't know until it comes. And whenever it starts to come, then we'll be able to tell more about what it's going to be like. And he said, but what I think is happening is as we are moving towards 2012, it's kind of like circling the drain. And when you start to circle the drain, it goes kind of slow at first, but then it spins up faster and faster and faster. And he said, once it hits December 21st, 2012, it's going to reach a level of complexity that is so unbelievably dense that it's going to change everything.
And we move towards singularity. Everything that can happen does happen. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're seeing, overlapping timelines. Everything that can happen is happening.
I love that video of him when he's sitting at the computer explaining this theory, and he's talking about how hemlines are rising and falling in sync with empires rising and falling. You know what I mean? Like, I love that. I love that. Yeah. All right.
Everything works together.
Yeah. It's perfect. Yeah. I think this is a good time to take a break. And then when we come back, we're going to ask everyone to move over and join us for the second hour at offplantradio.com. We're going to get into dance music and psychedelic realms. But before we go out, Chris has been kind enough to grace us with a track of his. You want to tell everybody what we're listening to?
It was a track I did just kind of on a whim a while back when I first started smoking DMT. And it's called Third Eye Open. I it's a track I completely forgot about, but it's obviously starting to come back to the surface now. So,
all right, excellent. So we'll listen to that and be back in just a few minutes. This is Off Planet Radio.
Your off-planet radio listening experience will return shortly.
We were in the center of the Amazon basin. We had come there to explore tryptamine, hallucinogens. These are short-acting, very powerful psychedelic drugs. It is true that when you smoke DMT, for example, at a sufficiently high and prepared dose, you get elves. Everybody does.
ब्रह्माधिपति ब्रह्मणोधिपति ब्रह्मा शिवो मे अस्तु सदा शिवो ईशान सर्वविद्यानां ईश्वर सर्वभूतानां ब्रह्माधिपति ब्रह्मणोधिपति ब्रह्मा शिवो मे अस्तु सदा
listening to Off Planet Radio at offplanetradio.com.
And welcome back to the second segment of Off Planet Radio. I'm Randy Moggins, Emily Moyer's here. Our guests are Chris and Sherry Geo, Truth Frequency Network. You are now on the site. You are now watching Hour 2. This is the ramp up to the subscriber site that will be coming in a few months. And I want to explain again, we're not doing this to be opportunist or elitist. This is simply the trajectory we have to take in order to present the kind of material we want to do in a setting that's safe, in a setting that's secure, and where there's values exchanged for information that's being put out and information received. So, you know, we'll release the details. I've gotten a lot of questions, a lot of emails, people hitting me on Facebook about it. The details aren't worked out. We'll make it doable. We'll make it possible. We'll make it affordable. And we will make it worth your while. And with that, we're going to go back into the show. Emily, kick us in.
All right. We're back with Chris and Sherry Geo. And before we get any further, guys, please let our listeners know where they can find you.
TFRlive.com.
All right. And your new show.
One-stop show for everything. And so, get you guys' show on the station. You know, yeah. I want to put that bug in your ear. Think about it. Let me know later.
All right. All right. So picking back up here, we wanted to get into a conversation about, Chris, like me, comes from the dance music scene. And we want to explore the possibility that environment kind of was a primer for what we're doing now, and kind of a open-minded exploration of truth and reality. So what do you think, Chris? How did you get into the party scene? And, you know, did that at all coincide or stimulate any parts of your waking up process?
I met this girl, and she was dealing X. And she's like, hey, you want to go?
Was it me?
Oh, we were getting it for $2 a pop back then. It was insane. So we wound up dating for a few years, and we just went to every single party for a couple different reasons, mostly to hang out and have fun. But I didn't really realize at the time what the rave scene was all about back then. As a musician, I just wanted to apply my skills into DJing, writing music, and things like that. I got a couple of gigs. I played with Kid Icarus, as a matter of fact, a couple of times.
Ah.
So, at a little club called Riches down in Houston. Yeah. I've never been there.
Yeah, but, of course. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So it's funny that we're all on the same track here. So the natural progression was to be a DJ. I didn't realize back then that the DJ was actually the shaman leading the crowd. And had I known back then what I know now, I would have applied so much more into helping people raise their consciousness. But it was a place that, number one, always felt really safe at these parties. People were always looking out for each other. If there was anybody ever acting out of line, strangers would come and help out with any kind of situation. It was just, you know, a place of love, unity, respect for one another. I hate to sound like a cheesy candy kid, but it was all about.
It was like that for a while. Yeah, there was. I mean, especially in you were from Texas, and mm-hmm. so you were partying there, and I'm from Los Angeles. One of the things I noticed when I moved to Texas was it was a much friendlier, tighter scene than here. I made more friends the first month I lived in Austin than my entire life here. And right. I still have those friends to this day. And yeah, I have more friends in Austin than I have here. Mm-hmm. So there was something interesting going on there. And it definitely, there was a feeling of sort of safety and tight-knit. It was tight-knit. And boy, is it different now. But
it was like a whole nother world. I mean, yeah. They would hire off-duty HPD that would guard the door. There was always an ambulance outside. The off-duty HPD did not mess with anybody rolling or tripping or anything like that. They would keep the real cops out and just created a really safe atmosphere.
Yeah.
And then all that changed when George Bush became governor of Texas. And as we were talking during the break, they implemented the crack house law, started coming down on the rave scene. And in hindsight, and I'm able to see why this happened, because when you have a group of kids congregating together, 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 at a time, like what was going on in California in some places, that's very dangerous to an establishment that's about to pull off a 9/11 and create an entire police state. So they needed to break that down first and foremost. There were some interesting things that happened right around that time too. In 99, 2000, right around that time, Sammy the Bull Gravano was the underboss of John Gotti. He snitched on John Gotti, testified against him, and then was relocated to Arizona in the Witness Protection Program. And I didn't find out about this until a few years ago. He was bringing in the majority of MDMA. And then at the exact, they wound up busting him because he thought that the FBI couldn't wire Nextel phones because the FBI used Nextel. He was completely off about that. Yeah. So they caught him on all these Nextel phones. So, but he was bringing in all the tabs, and they were good tabs. And, at the exact same time, they also busted one of the biggest LSD manufacturers as well. So suddenly the entire scene just went dry of everything. And I had never seen meth before up to that point. Yeah. And then they started introducing meth and all of these drugs that kill the consciousness as opposed to elevating the consciousness. So the entire scene just completely changed, like seemingly overnight. And then the DA also put sassafras or saffron.
Yeah.
On the watch list. So now you've got all these dealers creating PMAs, 2CB, so on and so forth. And it just completely killed the entire scene. If it would have kept going, I think that they wouldn't be able to pull off their agenda the way they did now, because there were so many people congregating together, thinking along the same lines of love, loving one another, and applying that into real world, outside of the rave scene. You can't have a society that's divided if they love each other.
Sure.
Ultimately, that's what it came down to.
I have to add in and chime in real quick. Pharmacologically, the difference between MDMA and amphetamine
one molecule
is serotonin versus dopamine. when you release serotonin, you release feelings of love, goodness, feeling just happiness. When you have too much dopamine, you get aggression, you get violence, you get hostility, paranoia, delusions, and just, you know, it's the complete opposite of what you are looking for in a rave scene.
Yeah. So, okay. So, but let's just, so I agree with a lot of the things you said. I also have done enough research at this point, and just from my own experiences, I was never at that period of time, I was never that into the whole MDMA thing. I was more into, I did it sometimes, but I was more into tripping or going to parties sober a lot. Not that I didn't do things outside of parties, but I was a break dancer. So for me, the level of being able to balance when I was dancing and stuff kind of dictated what I was wanting to do. But I was
one of the candy kids running around. So
I did that sometimes too. But, you know, like, so for me, I experienced it many different ways. And I do think that we are looking at
the big kickwear.
I didn't wear those, but it doesn't work for breakdancing. But I know what kind you are. I probably seen you before, dude. But do you think, let's take our scene and compare it to what was going on. Let's look at Dave McGowan's work in Laurel Canyon. Do you think that this was a scene created to then be brought down the way it was, to then usher in the kind of scene we're seeing now, where like all of these big festivals are like just total mind control fests, right?
Let me pause here on this for a minute, because the scenario Chris just ran through
of
what happened as the MDMA and the good stuff dried up. There's an exact parallel to that in what happened at the end of the 1960s, the beginning of the 1970s, with LSD, and specifically the pure LSD, the Sandoz formula.
LSD-25.
LSD-25. There were other strains of that that were synthesized, diluted, mixed, and otherwise adulterated. You saw the introduction of benzedrine, dexedrine, as well into the drug well. And then it went into a Schedule I controlled substance. And that was the entry point, because remember, we're still in Vietnam at that point. That was when the heroin started to come in. And that's when you started to see the scene change dramatically, almost overnight. You went from a Woodstock scenario, which, by the way, was a staged event, not exactly the way it was promoted, but we use it as a benchmark, into what became Altamont Speedway in California in 69. The Rolling Stones concert, where they hired Hell's Angels to be security, and they stomped a guy to death right in front of the stage. So there was a culture shift that happened there, and a lot of it was engineered to remove what we would call the Age of Aquarius vibe, the love vibe that was going on in that time, and it dropped in this dark satanic vibe that then cascaded into the implosion of the wave that had come in at that point. So. Yes. You know, there's a lot of psyops within psyops in all of this.
Right. So then it's
really interesting, because it sounds exactly like what happened.
Exactly the same.
If I remember correctly, this happened in 1999. So now we have 69 and 99 all lining up together.
And also remember, there was in 1999, there was the second coming of Woodstock, which was now a dance music festival that they had at Woodstock. And then that was the year that people really started dying at raves. So the rave is now turning into like a death ritual, almost like it was happening Altamont Speedway, right? So we have something moved from this lovey-dovey kind of thing that, even though we're probably, you know, screwing around or whatever, it's mostly a lovey thing. People are having a good time. People are sharing thoughts and ideas and whatnot. And then they pull part of the gas that made that go, replace it with a more synthetic, contrived, possibly, I'm even into looking at some of these drugs as being programmable matter. Designer drugs that have actually contained programs in them. So like maybe the MKUltra is inside the drugs as opposed to just the drugs being used for MKUltra. I'm to that level of thinking about things. So then you have people dying at raves, and you have this, you know, crackdown, but that also just makes people sort of want it more, which then allows them to remove it for a while, and bring in a much more commercialized and controlled version that we have now with these enormous festivals like Ultra and Tomorrowland and stuff, where if you look at these, it looks like a New World Order ritual taking place, and people just absolutely like going with there's a DJ up there who sucks, who doesn't make good music, with all these esoteric symbols that nobody in the audience has any idea what they mean, and they've got people moving in unison and chanting at terrible music. It's almost like watching, like, you know, when all the people move in unison to Hitler, you know what I mean? Or when it's disturbing. Mark Devlin and I talked about this on his radio show. It's disturbing. And so I think we're seeing the exact same thing play out in dance music that we saw in that rock music of the late 60s and early 70s that Dave McGowan so wonderfully recounted in his books. And I remember reading those articles when he had articles before they turned into a book, and I started going, what am I involved in? Like, this is exactly what's going on here.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think it's possible that some of these events are used for the snowflake programming?
Sure. I think they're used for all kinds. I'm to the spot where I think I see the frequencies, because the dance music is the one music that is based entirely on frequency, since there's almost no voice and there's not regular instruments. We're talking about layered electronic frequencies. I'm looking at some of these frequencies as being carriers of information. So people actually they're there having a good time and don't realize they're not only being programmed by the environment and what they're seeing in the light shows, they're being programmed by the frequencies that are hitting their head. I think at smaller parties, people are being observed. I think there's people there experimenting with psychotronic weaponry that nobody would even understand was there, because there's so much other stimulation coming that they don't understand that possibly thoughts and ideas are being beamed into their head.
Well, dubstep is really totally interesting in and of itself. When I first heard it, I thought to myself, this isn't really a vibe that I want to take some MDMA to or some LSD to. There was a weird undertone to it that seemed
very dark.
Alien, dark, and I think you might be onto something. Maybe it's a form of programming.
Well, and then also the type of music that has kind of branched off of dubstep, we have music called glitch, twitch, and trap. Mm-hmm. Like, it's basically telling you what is going on. Like, they're not even hiding it anymore, right? So, right. I've been to some events, not the kind that I go to, but I went to an event that a friend was playing at where there was some of that kind of music happening. And I literally felt like I was sitting in the MKUltra programming chair. You know what I mean? Like, the visuals were not pleasant to look at and harmonic. They were like coming at me. Like, I felt like they were going to hit me in the face. You know what I mean? And the sound was just like, it was crazy. You know, those, when you see those videos from like the 70s of people being programmed in MKUltra and they're sitting in the chair with the wires in their head. That's what it felt like, but it's a party. And I'm just looking at the kids and they're just taking it. They're taking it. They're like, not, it doesn't even seem to be phasing them.
I went through a period where I needed to channel some darkness out of me. And the way I did that is I wrote a dubstep track based on the TV series Dexter. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but it's about a serial killer. Yeah. And as I was writing it, I was thinking to myself, you know, this is really some dark stuff. And just the energy that I was putting into it was purposefully dark so I could channel it out of me and expel it. But if that's the basis of this entire genre, then that's telling in and of itself.
Yeah. I mean, I, again, like with anything, there's artists in there who are coming from a pure place. But we have to look at, I mean, there, just like you can find connections with the music of the 60s and 70s to Tavistock Institute and things like that, you can find the same connections to people in the dance music world. You find the same sort of process of how, like, someone who has actually no interest in the music, who's like some kind of weird businessman with, you know, intelligence agency or military connections, is the person who sort of ushers in this new version of it. And so, I mean, you can find all the same stuff. So that's interesting to me. You haven't looked there. Yeah. I mean, check into some of that stuff. And I would love to know what you think, because you were around at that same time. You started about the same time that I did. Maybe mm-hmm. I think I'm a little older than you, so maybe I started a little earlier. But, you know, I've watched this whole thing change. And here, we just found out in the last few years about the stuff that happened in the 60s and 70s, only in the last, right? We're figuring this out when we're still, this music, we can still salvage some of this. Like, we can still take back control of some of this part of our, you know, reclaim this part of our culture that is really important to this. I don't know about you, but I feel like I would not be sitting here talking to you and aware of the things I'm aware of in the world if it hadn't been for my experiences with that with dance music. It really changed the way I see everything. And so it disturbs me to think that people won't be able to have that anymore.
Well, not only that, but when I met Chris, the only thing I had ever even heard about MDMA was that it's bad for you, it's going to kill you, you're going to have hyperthermia, and you're going to die of a seizure. You know, I mean, that was, you know, that was what I was told. And while, you know, you guys were going to raves, the only thing that kids like me had access to in 1999 when I turned 16 was like Coricidin and over-the-counter cough medicine, things like that. I mean, it was awful. I mean, kids were almost dying. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, why would they?
That was the scene in the early 70s, too, when they dried up. I mean, and they dried up the weed, they dried up mescaline, peyote, all of the organic drugs. And I remember this. What came in was Quaaludes, the early forms of meth, Benzedrine, Dexedrine, reds, whites, the classic.
Yeah, the crosses, white crosses, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what they always do. They dry up the organics and then they drop in the pharmacological drugs, which have all this negative, heavy black shit attached to them. Mm-hmm. And they shift the culture. And it's now so refined because not only are we in accelerated time frames culturally, I mean, I don't understand the electronic music scene. Emily and I talk about this a lot. I try to keep up with it. I don't know all the fine distinctions between house music and dub and deep house. And I mean, the genres now are so, there's so many of them that I'm not sure where it all bleeds in. I'm kind of like into ambient music now, electronic ambient music. But the ability to re-engineer culture is now very speeded up because of the effects of the digital world as well, because a lot of the changes that are taking place in music now are subliminal, and they're being done in the digital realm.
Yeah, and I think there's aspects. I mean, I'm not endorsing or unendorsing use of drugs or psychedelics. You know, like I have ones that I'm partial to. I think there are some dangerous things about MDMA, even when it was in its original form. I think it's useful. I think they're using it in, you know, to treat depression and things. Now I think it has uses, but I've also watched people take way too much of it. And I've watched it feminize men. I've watched it make, you know, some people really suicidal and depressed. So for each person, it's up to them to know, to use their discernment and what their body can take and what they can handle. I feel differently about more natural drugs like, yeah, marijuana, psilocybin, and you know, and ayahuasca and things like that. But even within that, I've enjoyed things like that, and I wouldn't be here without those experiences. But I also, at this point in my life, see some of the dangers for some people. It isn't for everybody, and you know, you really have to take care of yourself and each other when you're engaging in those things. And even you guys, like I'm sure I've listened to you guys enough talk about your experiences. Sounds like you're really creating. You know, you're setting your intent and you're taking care of each other and you're taking care of people you're doing it with. We'll move into a talk about psychedelics in just a second, but just to round out the whole thing with the dance music scene here, I just think that it's something that's gotten way away from us, you know, and I think that, like, it's a unique, I mean, I don't know about for you, but the first time I ever, did you have that moment at a party? For me, it came, you know, probably when I was on acid and, you know, enjoying, you know, in the middle of the circle at the Austin City Music Hall where I was observing myself. Did you ever have one of those? Okay. And that never happened to me before then. And I think that allowed for what I'm doing now. I don't know that I'd have gotten here. You know, would you agree with that, Randy? I mean, you had your experiences, you know, back in your day. Would you agree that some of those experiences have helped you to be able to do what we're doing the way we're doing it?
Yeah, on both sides of it, because I'm very aware of the fact that drugs were used in programming.
Yeah, of course.
So my claim is basically where I had control over drugs, some not so good stuff, and yet some profound things as well. I did mescaline and peyote as probably my formative hallucinogenics, and I have to say that the peyote was the most challenging, but it was the most rewarding because it was like a, it was like opening up another dimension. And it was very vivid. It was very intense physically and psychically. And it's my most memorable thing. I did LSD once voluntarily. It was okay. I spent a lot of time trip-sitting people who did LSD. So some of my understanding of LSD is from watching other people do this from a safer perspective of kind of being a shepherd through that experience and what people went through. And the commonality with all of this is you have to be in the right place. You have to be in a safe place. You should have as pure a substance as you can get, as organic as you can get. And the most important thing of all is that you have to trust your environment psychically because you're opening yourself up. You know, I'm interested to hear what Chris and Cherie have to say about ayahuasca because it's one of my concerns about ayahuasca, doing it without a shaman, because I'm very familiar with people who have gone down to Peru and done this, and I know that the shaman is a key aspect to this. So I'm kind of interested to get you guys' take on some of the experiences you've had with ayahuasca.
You okay. Why don't you rip into it? Go for it.
Let me chime in on MDMA first of all.
Sure.
I don't think MDMA is useful for anything except for fucking all night. That's really, I mean, what it comes down to. We went to, she's never done it before.
Yeah.
So back in 2010, Roger Waters was doing the wall down in Houston and we were down there visiting and I popped pills in her mouth and said, come on, let's go see Roger Waters. We didn't have any LSD or anything, but we had that. And then it was just like all night long.
Yeah.
Like but you know, the problem with MDMA is it sucks your entire brain out of you afterwards. And then there's like a 3-day recovery time. It's like, no, I'm too old for that. But I know a lot of the kids are doing it. So, you know, it's, we all go through those phases. I went through that phase as well. LSD as well. I feel that it's a copy of psilocybin.
Yeah.
And why go to the copy when you can go to the actual?
It's like a digital version. It's like digital as opposed to organic. It's like a, yeah, it is. I agree with you completely. When, yeah, I did it before I ever did mushrooms. And when I did mushrooms, I was like, oh, this is way better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, the fact that LSD was, I'm sorry, I walked on you there.
Oh, no.
The fact that LSD was used, the way it was used inside of MK Ultra programs is all, you know, you really need to know about it. It was it's a very dangerous drug. There are people who did not recover. I had a friend who lost his mind over a combination of LSD and mescaline, literally spent the rest of his life in a mental institution. He just lost it.
I will say that there was an MK Ultra experiment, a certain experiment where a Nazi doctor brought a group of school children into a room.
Yes.
And then shot up an elephant with like, I think it was like 3,000 mics of LSD. And the elephant died in front of all those children. And they just did it just to see what it would do.
Well, I've seen some videos where they try to, they give LSD to like soldiers. And they try to get them to do certain things. And the soldiers are just, they're doing their own thing. They're not, so it's kind of controversial in my opinion. Can LSD really be used for mind control? Or did they find out that it has the opposite effect? I don't know.
It can be used under controlled circumstances. It absolutely can be used to split the consciousness. They're very aware of the dosages. They're very aware of the time lapse that occurs in the pulse of that drug, of what effects it's taking. There's physiological signs. You wouldn't do this in a normal experience. In a laboratory situation where you have a controlled dosage, we have the ability to monitor. Absolutely, they use it for splitting consciousness because they know the exact breakpoints in the psyche.
And not only that, they know it's a copy substance. It's a synthetic substance. So whatever spirit they want to put in that, they can put whatever spirit they want into it.
They can charge it. Good point.
They can
charge it. Have you ever read Operation Mind Control by Walter Boehr?
No.
I have not.
That's you know, he talks about in there being dosed with a really like super strong kind of LSD that basically put him on like a 40-day trip that he was actually bilocating as part of this trip.
Mm.
Right. So you check out that book sometime. His account, it's very interesting.
Well, I can tell you this about MDMA. I had a very bad experience, but it wasn't MDMA. It was something else. I don't know what it was. PMA, 2CB, who the hell knows? But it was some kind of adulterant. We had bought like 20 or 30 of them. And we were just going to keep them just to eat at a later time. And we were going to eat a couple that night and that's it. Well, it wasn't really working. It was weak. So I'd pop another one. And then I'd forget that I'd popped one and I'd pop another one and another one.
The white clovers?
I don't remember what they were. But it was sometime in like 2003, 2004, maybe 2002.
Okay.
It may have been white clovers now that I think about it. But I wound up taking about 15 that night.
Yep.
And I went into a 5-day psychosis. I thought people were trying to kill me. I was seeing numbers written all over the wall. I was seeing like mathematical equations and
this
just
is what I'm talking about.
All kinds of weird shit. I didn't know what I had taken. And so now I tell anybody that's using MDMA, you've got to get a Regis test. You've got to test it.
What if that was programmed into it? Like, what if there was actually like, you know, think about it, like programmable matter is anything that has some kind of sort of crystalline kind of substance that you can
digital drugs, basically.
So digital drugs. Didn't you ever have an experience when you're on stuff where suddenly everything was like super pixelated and seemed very digital, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what if that's actually what's happening? You know, like, what if it, like, you know, so I mean, you just said you were seeing numbers across the wall. Think about that. What if you were seeing the code that was programmed into that drug?
It could be. In hindsight, yeah. I think about it from the perspective of seeing the matrix code, the simulation code. But it's an entirely new perspective that you just presented. So I've got to really meditate on that. But something was seriously wrong and it fucked me up so bad that for about 2 years afterwards, I couldn't even smoke a joint. Because when I would smoke a joint, I would just get super paranoid. And then the ayahuasca broke all of that. So, you know, leading into the ayahuasca.
Tell us how you got into that. Like, because just for the listeners, Chris and Cherie have been for years now doing ayahuasca ceremonies and recording and speaking about their experiences. So why don't you tell us how you got into it, what the experience is like, and whatever you'd like to share with us about that.
Well, I was listening to Joe Rogan talking about DMT, and I thought, you know, wow, this is really interesting. And I had a dream of, I was in the mountains, and I was in Texas at the time. I've never been around mountains in my life. I mean, I think I went, so I saw mountains once as a kid or something, but I was in the mountains, and this limousine pulls up, and there's this house that's being built right next to it. And this old lady steps out, and she says, "Do you know who I am?" And I said, "I think you're my grandmother." My grandmother was a shaman. And I said, "I think you're my grandmother." And she says, "We're going to start building this house together, but it's not yet built, but we're going to build it together." And something sparked within me to just get in touch with the native side of me. I've always grown up with my mother's side, which is Greek. And so I always went down that road, and I never really got in touch with my native side. So that was the first spark, kind of a calling. The ancestor came to me. And then I started listening to Joe Rogan and said, you know what? I got to try this DMT stuff. But I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to find it. I didn't know any of that. And I came across some salvia. And I smoked the salvia, and I was listening to Comfortably Numb. And I was like, I remember this place. It's been so long since I've been here. Oh, my God. So then the DMT kind of sparked from there. And when we first met, we were smoking DMT like every 2 days. And we really were able to see within us who we are, the twin flame element of all of this. Mm-hmm. We could see each other's spiritual bodies in without any of the matter there. It was pretty incredible. But it wasn't as fulfilling as ayahuasca because it happened so quick.
You did DMT first.
Yeah, I did DMT first. DMT is kind of like trying to read a book, but flipping the pages in front of you really quick. Yeah. You might be able to pick up on the title of a chapter, but that's about all the information you're going to absorb. Ayahuasca is like actually reading the book. It takes you through the entire journey deep into the realm, and you can really absorb all the information. And at first, it was communing with Cherie, wrapping our spiritual bodies around each other, things like that. Maybe a few encounters with a few different entities. We saw these little kazoos pop up in the room and they were running around and little like trolls,
little
and
builders,
little elves. Yeah. And they were just like working on stuff. And
the machine elves. Yes.
Yeah. And one time we had this shared experience where I think when we extracted it, we didn't let it dry out enough. And there was like some naphtha left inside of the DMT. And it was like we got off on the wrong floor.
The wrong floor.
And there was this gray alien standing in front of us. And he was like cussing us out. And like, what the fuck are you doing here? Get the fuck out of here. You're not fucking supposed to be. Like really aggressive. And he was like jumping at
us. Hostile.
And during the experience, I thought I was the only one seeing it. And she's like, what the fuck is that?
Pissed.
He was pissed. And I'm like, what did you see? And she's like, I saw this fucking alien. And he was right there.
He's right in our faces.
So
what do you think that is though? Wait a second. So you extract it. So we're still talking about DMT, right? Not ayahuasca.
Yeah.
So something was different in the way it was made or what?
Yeah, I think we didn't clean it out enough. Evaporated, so there was a little bit extra of the stuff that's left.
Isn't that weird though that like something different about the chemical?
Yes.
Like brings, what is that? Right.
It changes the dynamic.
Changes
so
the whole thing.
You take a look at LSD and other things like
that.
Yeah.
That's what, yeah.
This is what I've been telling people recently is you don't know what you're getting on the street. Mm-hmm. And you may think that pure LSD doesn't have any toxicity, but you don't know if the chemist went through the whole acid wash and everything all properly. You don't know what the hell's in there. So then we started drinking ayahuasca. And the ayahuasca at first was pretty much the same, going into these realms, communing with entities and so on and so forth. But then there came a point, now you got to deal with your shit. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't want to deal with my shit. And they're like, no, you're going to deal with your shit.
But I want another light show. No, you're going to deal with your shit now.
One of the experiences I had was I had three boxes in front of me that just like appeared. And they were kind of energetic boxes. And it was telling me, go open the box. And I'm like, I don't want to open the box.
Like, I remember hearing you talk about this.
I don't want to open the box. Yeah. What's in the box?
And it was childhood trauma that I had suppressed. So I was opening one box. There was another box. There was the third box I haven't opened yet. And I'm deathly afraid what's in that box. I feel as though there's something sexual there from my childhood that I don't remember. I just get that feeling. And I'm like, I don't want to open that fucking box. There was one instance where I took a sword, like a light sword, and just cut the tether to the box. And I'm like, I don't care what's in the box, but I'm not going to be chained to these boxes anymore. But then there was another experience where I had to go back and revisit the boxes again. And I'm like, look, I already broke the tether. Just leave me the fuck alone. Nope. You're going to deal with this. So there's this whole breakdown of who you are, your programming and so on and so forth. And, you break down the idea, like we were talking about in the first hour, the truth or programming, the political programming, the religious programming, everything starts to dissolve, but you have to allow it to. And some of the experiences can be kind of frightening. I mean, you'll see demon faces show up in front of you. And those demon faces are not real, but rather they're kind of like a security system. Like, can you stare down? Have you come to the point where you can stare this vision down? If so, you can pass through and then you find your enlightenment on the other side. So it's kind of a... It's kind of a test. And that's what I've realized. And I realized like the more I let go, the more I go into the experiences, the more tests that I overcome, the more enlightenment that I start to get to. And then after that, like when the ego was completely dissolved, then I was able to be rebuilt again, rebuilt as who I am now. And there was an entire long process of working with the plants to really understand who I am now. I don't know how much detail you want me to get into, but
get into as much detail as you want. There's a lot of you know, there's a lot of people out there interested about the experience, and we're marveling at the parallels from some other conversations we've been having that have nothing to do with psychedelics. So go for it. Go as far as you
okay. As you like. So you were talking with Zach Hubbard, and I was listening to that show. He mentioned ISIS. So I went in. And I was talking to Frank, and I'm like, you know, Frank, I'm having real trouble with music right now. I don't know what's going on. I just can't grab that creativity. And he's like, man, you got to go in there and you got to just tell him you want to be tapped in at all times. And I said, okay. So I went in there and I said, I want to be tapped in at all times. And it took a few experiences in order to get to this particular point. But first experience was like the DNA being arranged, restructured. Another experience was I could see all of the files in my brain being rearranged, being defragmented, some junk files being removed, and everything just completely rearranged. And then I saw this purple beam of light appear in front of me, and this female voice, and she said, "Do you know who I am?" And I said, I don't know. And she said, I'm the mother. And she was just a beam of light. And she says, "What do you want?" And I said, "Well, I want to be purified and I want to be tapped in." And she said, "Step into my light." And so I stepped into the light, and she just kind of bathed me and purified me in this purple light. And then a microchip, a little pink microchip appeared. And she said, "Don't be afraid of the form. It's just something that you'll understand." Because, you know, the truth or programming microchip, yeah. One and so forth. And then all of a sudden I saw these pyramids just appear in front of me. There were like 9 of them. And I could tell they were each different parts of my brain. And I took the microchip and she said, "Go put this wherever you want." And I said, "Well, I don't know what part of my brain is what." I mean, it was just all, it looked exactly the same, but I instinctively knew, go to the center pyramid and go to the bottom to the king's chamber. And I found a little place, boom, to put the microchip in. And then I felt my consciousness at that point. It was a pineal gland. So I felt that my consciousness just all of a sudden just spread through the entire universe all the way around, just start wrapping around. And she said, "Now you're tapped in." So I started communing with her a little more as we started to journey even more. And I realized at that point, there is a ritual taking place with the whole ISIS terrorist group. Mm-hmm. ISIS symbolizes love, mother, empathy, perfect wife, perfect mother, that motherly love.
Feminine energy, the best feminine energy. Yeah.
Yes, the divine feminine energy. So now we have the entire world screaming, "Kill ISIS, destroy ISIS, get ISIS, fear ISIS."
They think ISIS is something that chops heads off.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we're killing human empathy now by chanting over and over and over again. And at that point, she started calling all of her babies. She's like, "Hey, guys, come on, wake up. It's go time. Come on, go shine your lights out there." So in another experience, after I'd been upgraded.
Real quick, before you go on. That was really interesting what you said about the chip and the purple light and the pyramids. Because from my own experiences and talking to some other people, been through projects and programs, I feel that there is something called pyramid programming. And I have memories of being in the king's chamber at the bottom of the pyramid and understanding how the visuals and acoustics work in the pyramid. Mm-hmm. And right. And so when I've had psychedelic experiences or even sometimes without them, I feel as though what I'm actually having is some kind of memory or recall of being there. Now, I don't know if that's being there in a past life or if that is part of my programming or whatever, but I don't know if you would call it remote viewing or just like past life recall or programming. I have watched, I understand in my body and bones how those pyramids, how the physics of the light and the sound work. They're spiritual chambers for people to sort of experience these same realms that you're going to with ayahuasca. That's what they're there for. And I've watched them build them. I understand how they used sound to basically levitate them into existence. And so it's very interesting to me that when you're there in that spot, she's telling you, okay, and so a lot of this stuff that's programming, we all have ideas that we have implants, we have chips, things like this, right? It is fascinating to me that this is how I'm deconstructing programming, and it's the same experience that you're having when you're going there. She's showing you the chip, showing you the pyramids, pick where to put it. I mean, it sounds like the same thing in reverse.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
That's fascinating, right? What is that? Randy, please chime in. Or Cherie?
Well, no, I'm listening. I'm listening.
I think that we've all done this before. Like everybody we're encountering now, this is all our soul family. We were in ancient Egypt together. We were doing
totally.
I was shown a life where I had a big mouth and I was riling people up to rebel against the power structure, and they crucified me and nailed me to a freaking tree at one point back in ancient Egypt. I think we've all played out these same archetypes over and over and over again, and we keep coming back trying to shift this reality into what it's supposed to be, into the higher levels of consciousness, and maybe we keep failing every single time, but this time, this is the final time, and I feel that we're going to be able to achieve our mission.
So I feel the exact same way, and this mirrors so much of what we were talking about with Og Teles the other day, that, you know, and what is going, like, is that part of what, like, MKUltra is like, we've all been there before, and they're sort of wanting to tap into our gnosis from those times to control it before we regain control of it.
There's a movie, Assassin's Creed. I don't know if you've seen, I haven't seen the movie, but I saw the previews. They take this guy, they put him in a machine, and he gets in touch with all of his ancestral memories, and that's what they want out
of this. It's based on a video game, actually.
That's exactly how the projects and programs work. So it is
most of what they're doing is trying to control a narrative that they lost control of. And that even feeds back into the last hour when we were talking about the Mandela effect. A lot of it is artifacts of timelines that have been edited. Yeah. Emily remembers a conversation we had one night, and a lot of what we do is deprogramming, induction. And I mentioned a missing part of me, which I saw as a piece of film strip that had been edited, but there was a frame that was pulled out, and it was not part of that sequence, and it was obvious. And that was very much a metaphor for something, and yet it was actual too, is that a lot of what we're getting is cut and paste. So the timelines have been truncated, edited, and very poorly edited back. It's like the aliens that can't put you back after they abduct you in your own clothes, even close to the house that they managed to pull you out of with pinpoint accuracy. There's like all this really sloppy art that goes on in these fuck all operations. So, you know, I looked at that as a metaphor for something that was going on. We're dealing with an attempt to either delete, edit, or in some way stem off the wave process that's going on right now. And you said it, this is the last round. We've been through at least 5 of these cycles before historically. This is the big one. They know it, we know it. We agreed to this. This was a game with rules. They didn't hold up their side of it. They didn't follow the rules. So now they're trying to cheat, because I think what is good about us cooperates with the outcome being on our side. You know, you call it universe, you can call it source, creator, whatever you want. We're fighting a war right now, and we're fighting it half blind, but we're still winning. Which I think is incredible.
Yeah, we're winning. Og had like a really good point the other day, in that we've already won, because they can't do anything without us. They feed off of our energy. So if they kill, they're parasites. If they kill us, they die. So there's no way that we're not going to win. They just keep convincing us that we're in danger of losing, and we keep falling for it over and over. And this time we have to not do it. We have to not get get all rebellious and do that kind of thing. This time we have to ignore the nonsense and just sort of walk away and create our own reality, as opposed to rail against the one that they've created for us and swear that we're going to overturn it. We just kind of have to go, oh, that's nice, bye.
That's one thing I remember from David Icke when we went in 2009 and listened to David Icke. He said, you've got all these people screaming at the movie screen. Why don't you just change the damn movie? Yeah. Change it completely and quit screaming at something that's not going to change.
Well, back to what we were saying in the first hour, I think that we have achieved a huge milestone in our goal, and that's when we shifted the timeline into the Donald Trump timeline.
Let's call it something better than the Donald Trump timeline, right? Well,
there could be better, it's a better step than what we were before.
Well, I will say this, based on my conversations with people who are very tuned in, people who are psychically gifted, remote viewers, we're going to look back on this period in much the same way that people look back on the early 1960s and JFK, where people don't remember now, and I remember my parents telling me this, how terrified people were of John F. Kennedy at the time, because they viewed him as a Roman Catholic, as a Vatican takeover of the United States. That, in fact, it then took 15 years after his death to even begin to fathom what he was actually involved with that resulted in what happened in Dallas. The fact that he had issued silver certificates, the fact that he was going after the mafia, he was going after the CIA, he had fired Alan Dulles. All of these events were Kennedy basically ripping the guts out of the cabal's power structure inside of the government, and that was intolerable. It looks to me like Trump has the potential to do that. Mm-hmm. It looks to me like it's going to be a quicker operation, and we'll pray that it does not require what happened in 1963 this time around. But I see it as a parallel.
And I think that's fascinating.
He's a time traveler. If he's a time traveler in any way, then he already knows what day and what hour and what minute that would happen. And so what he's doing, I think, is, you know, and this is just a weird theory we came up with a few weeks ago, is that every time he gets shot, he just restarts the program again and goes through it again and says, okay, this time I'm going to make sure that this person is right here to save me from this. And he's playing his cards
every single time. He basically has infinite lives.
He's basically stacking the probabilities because he's aware of the probabilities, which is actually what multidimensionalism is. When we get into that, you know, you're dealing with probable futures, all of which not only can happen, but actually do happen.
This takes us,
and the trick is to be able to move in and out of the probabilities in this focused sequential timeline.
And if he has the Tesla technology, and he's and well, this also takes me back to, wait a second, aren't all the presidents time travelers? Let's go ask Andrew Basiago if Donald Trump was in the lineup as well, right?
And, right.
Or maybe he hijacked that. Maybe he wasn't part of that program, but because they secretly had that technology, he's been doing the same thing that they were doing, but without the control of the power structure. That was
exactly.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
We remember, too, that Andrew stated that all the presidents from Reagan forward, the chronovisor had already predicted their presidency. That went up to Obama.
Yeah.
Now, I haven't interviewed Andy since 2012, and I haven't talked to him in a long time, but I'm curious to know now.
You guys have interviewed him, haven't you?
We had him recently.
Yeah.
And I was a little unclear about, I'd have to go back and listen to the archive, but to my understanding, and I may be misquoting him, he believed that he was going to be the president in this term.
He did run for president. He actually...
But he was in that same program with Bush and Obama and whatever. And so if Trump secretly has this technology that they didn't know he had from his family, and he has basically hijacked that and taken it over... That makes sense.
Right.
Yeah, he went rogue.
He went,
I think he went rogue, and
this is
that's why
it would also,
everything would, has gotten so awesome.
It would also make sense why he's being security guarded by an observer then, Randy.
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it?
I mean, that's...
You know, but I think the thing about it is, all your probabilities play off of each other. We are multiple universes within ourselves. So we're playing stacked probabilities against stacked probabilities. People who sit outside of time, which again, you know, I don't want to keep bringing Og up, but that's one of the things that he's talking about as well. People who sit out of time understand the interplay between stacked timelines and probabilities. So in fact, what was required in order to pull this thing from the brink being that Hillary Clinton would assume the presidency, was you needed a very high-stakes game. You needed a very big player. And I'm given to understand that Trump himself did not expect to win and was quite surprised when that happened, but that, in fact, things were put in motion. Now he knows his role, because sometimes when we're walking through a timeline, We're not aware of our own role until the moment we step into it. It's like destiny.
If he was sent to do this by himself in the future, then the him now wouldn't know it was going to happen until it happened.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow, guys. This is, I love this conversation. All right. And so.
Let me ask you something, Randy, real quick. I have a theory on Palestine, and I want to see how this resonates with you. I feel that area has been quarantined because there's a bloodline that they're systematically trying to eliminate, and they're looking for one particular individual, and they can't seem to find them, so they're just killing everybody indiscriminately. What do you think about that idea?
I haven't heard it before, and I haven't considered it, but it wouldn't surprise me because there's definitely something going on there. Mm-hmm. Why they've quarantined that area, why there is this vendetta that seems beyond reason at this point. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the Palestinians are characterized there, there may actually be some interplay going on even between the perception of some sort of antichrist seed, mm-hmm. which I've considered in the past, which is a reversal of the truth.
Right.
You know, what if the actual seed bloodline is on the Palestinian side and not on the Israeli side? Yeah. Because remember something, we can keep coming back to this idea that the so-called Jews are Khazars. Mm-hmm. And if you go back and you look at the history of the Khazarians, there were bloodline vendettas that were waged even when they were in that region.
Absolutely. In fact, they were kicked out of so many different countries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they would go into a country, they would act like they were Jewish, but then they would start problems in the
same thing over and over and over again. Yeah.
Same thing over and over again. They start problems between two groups of people, and then if one group of people catches on and tells the other group of people, hey, they're against both of us, they're trying to get us to fight with one another, then they would tell them, hey, get the hell out of our country. And as a result, then they would say, okay, well, from now on, we're your enemy, and we will take you down no matter how long it takes us.
The distortions that have gone on with that, and again, this was what I went on the shortwave radio to talk about, was it wasn't to push the Khazarian thing, and it wasn't against Jewish people per se. It is against Zionism and what Zionism actually is, mm-hmm. which is a fanatical religion that was fomented by the bloodline families long ago. It's a weaponized religion going the whole way back to Yahweh. Yahweh is not the Father. Jesus said this very clearly. He told the Sanhedrin of their time, you are your father, the devil.
Yep.
You don't even need to read outside the Bible to get that message. Mm-hmm. He very clearly was at war with these people then. Look at his bloodline. And who was he? He was probably in the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I saw that go right across. You got it, yeah.
I want to try and tie some.
I just want to say the Essenes were mystics to the core.
Yes, absolutely.
And they hated the Sanhedrin, and they hated the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They hated them, but not the same way that we hated Clinton. That was the same way that they hated them. And it wasn't a hate, you know, oh, I just want to destroy all of them. It was a hate as in, why don't you just let up? You know, this is the true message. The true message is what's inside of people. It's not the message of, you know, do this or I'll spank you.
Well, I didn't want to just come out and say it, but I mean, I think you did, Randy. I think there is I hate to use the word Messiah. I hate to use the word, you know, any of those words because it all has a religious context to it or condemnation.
Christos archetype.
There's a Christ consciousness.
Yes, absolutely.
They're trying to extinguish.
So I want to try and wind, I like their theory about Palestine. I want to try and wind some of this back together. All the wars that we do in the Middle East, I think they're really about finding pieces of technology, of ancient technology. They're looking for them. And now maybe the person that they're looking for is the person that can make all those technologies work.
If you watch Essenes had technology.
If you watch Fringe, again, we'll go back to Fringe, they were assembling this giant, like what would you even call that sort of, this thing that basically, you know.
The machine.
The machine, right? The machine that can connect the two different universes, that can do all this kind of stuff, right? And the person that could power it was Peter. And Peter was constantly being written out of timelines and reappearing in timelines and, you know, whatever. And only he, when he touched the technology, it like snapped on and did all this crazy stuff. And before that, it was just pieces of heavy metal. So what if the person that they're looking for in Palestine, they want to eliminate them before he can make the machine work, because the machine can, you know, the technology is, you know, is something magical. They want to have control over that.
That is very interesting.
I mean, we've seen everybody from Hitler to our regime right now trying to find all these different mm-hmm. artifacts. The first mission that we ran in Iraq is called Operation Planet X. And it was supposedly to go secure a village, but 11 miles away was Saddam Hussein's museum.
Yeah.
Tablets and so on and so forth. Some people speculate that Saddam actually had a Stargate, and that's what the invasion of Iraq was all about, and then every other country there. So I think you're spot on.
Well, and remember, Aaron McCollum talked about that with the Gulf of Aden in Yemen, too, and we're about to go to war. You know, and Saudi Arabia is making war in Yemen right now. Same thing, right? And that's always the deal.
Let's not forget the discovery of the, well, we'll call it the holographic chronovisor inside the cave in Göbekli.
Have you guys seen that?
Transylvania sunrise.
Transylvania.
Transylvania.
I haven't seen it.
The Göbekli cave.
Yeah.
Okay, so there is an entire possibility that there were three of those, because they usually do a triangulation.
Yeah.
So you had one in Baghdad, or one somewhere near where Saddam Hussein was rebuilding Babylon. You have artifacts in the Baghdad Museum. What if you have the third cave somewhere in Palestine? It's the center of the earth.
Yeah. No, I mean, it makes that
prophecy,
the main one probably.
See, I don't reject prophecy. I don't even really reject the Bible. I reject the way it's been interpreted and the way it has been translated. But within it, there's some seeds there. But I see it as the prophecy of the man-child in Revelation, because I never really saw Jesus predicting his own second coming. He's talking about the Son of Man. The book of Revelation talks about the man-child. So that kind of goes into what you were talking about earlier, Chris, in terms of what if there's somebody there that they're trying to get to who has the technology to turn all the grids back on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We had an ayahuasca experience where we saw all of the pyramids being activated.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a call, you have to go to Egypt and you have to go touch those stones.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I probably shouldn't be talking about this in public. However, I will.
This isn't the members that this isn't a website.
This is what we do. This is what we do. We get people to say things. Okay.
We were told to get a team of 5 to 6 people, go down to the Great Pyramid and drink ayahuasca. I'll focus our energies on manifesting some kind of object that we'll bring back with us.
Mm.
It sounds crazy, I know.
Not to me. It sounds about right to me.
And that this object would create a wave within the Great Pyramid that would activate it, but not in the sense that it was created, in the sense that it would lift the veil from everybody's eyes simultaneously throughout the world.
You think this object is some kind of crystal type of thing?
It's a Merkaba.
It's a Merkaba.
Do you think it's a crystal Merkaba? Because you think it's a stone Merkaba?
I don't know, but after the experience, Cherie was watching Terrence McKenna, and he was talking about when they went down to the rainforest and that they manifested this object out of the DMT room. Dennis touched it and went insane.
Completely bonkers.
Yeah.
For several days.
So, I don't know. It's funny because the ayahuasca, we're channeling a lot of information that we're later reaffirming.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes me feel that the information is valid that we're bringing back with us. But now you're giving me an entirely different perspective now. Because what if it is a program?
Right.
And if it is a program, I have to entertain that very real possibility.
This is my ultimate theory about what all this stuff is. What if we set the program? What if we're from Atlantis and we saw a catastrophe coming, and Egyptian Book of the Dead kind of stuff, right? We did something to preserve our consciousness so that we could somehow catch up with it later.
I think that's exactly what happened.
We could catch up with it later. And the people who caused the cataclysm, or the people who invaded after the cataclysm, figured out that we did something like that, and they've been trying to hijack it. And they almost have it, but they don't have it exactly right because it's encrypted in our DNA, and it only works for us to open it. So they can try and look at it, but it doesn't, like, it's kind of like, you know computer code, I don't. If I look at the code you write, I'm going to see the letters that you've, the numbers that you've put there, but I'm not going to know what they mean, but you are. It only works for you because you wrote the code.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, it's called syntax.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, okay, yes. So these programs are basically hijacking. It's almost like we created some kind of, in my head, it's some kind of geometrical grid out, like, you know, like we did some kind of like sacred geometry pattern to ourselves as this was happening. That, because I think this is how programs work. They're programming you using sacred geometry and chakra points and then ley lines of the earth and all this kind of thing. We did this. We created this program for us to be able to find ourselves, and it's been hijacked. And maybe turning some of these things on, like you're talking about, these ley lines and these energy points in the earth, would sort of reorient it for us to be able to sort of snap back into it. They're trying to hijack all of this stuff and program us to get to us to do what we want, what they want us to do. So we never, you know, right? They're using the very sort of skills and information that we had in us all along, and that we were trying to preserve so we could catch up to later, because we knew the cataclysm was coming, but we knew that we were eternal and we could find ourselves again. And the whole thing, we're just trying to find the selves that we sort of, you know, put into some kind of like a secure lockdown. Right. And they're trying to hijack. They're trying to break into the safe.
Right. I mean, and if they can catch you when you're young,
yep,
and put you on all kinds of pharmaceuticals and get your brain completely fried and make sure your neurons don't work properly by the time you're 25 or 26 and your neurological system's finished developing and it's not going to develop any further, right, then they've got you.
Yep.
You are never going to fulfill that purpose.
Or on the flip side, if they can take all of those abilities you have, it's people in projects and programs, and get you to use them in ways that help them trying to figure out what you already, right? They're trying to figure out what you know. They're sending you into
You're acting as a spy without warning.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Spy versus, right?
Let me take a step further. When I first realized this Yahweh thing, I realized that it was a virus in the matrix, and that's how I first saw it. What if these energies, ISIS and these other energies, are actually antivirus, and they've deployed us as the antivirus to completely overturn all of this?
Yeah, that
evict the virus out of the matrix for good.
Yeah, that's what we were talking about. And I had a private conversation with Og Telez that we put on the internet before we interviewed him. And we were basically talking about that, is that we're kind of here to clean up. There's some of us who have been taken advantage of and used as operatives, but we're really here in our real mission to clean out the system so we can have our home back. Maybe the home isn't somewhere else. Maybe it's like clean the infection out of our home, because this is where home has been all along. It's just been completely hijacked, laid over, put a bunch of stuff, you know, a bunch of different like veils and layers and constructs over it. And we need to clean all that stuff out, remove the false grid that's been laid over us, and we're home.
Living in Texas, do you remember those big ass cockroaches that were like
huge,
so huge, and they would fly?
Yeah.
That's what it's like. It's like you see one in your house and you're like, okay, well, you know, that's fine. We'll deal with it. And you smash it and it's over. Then the next day there's three. And then the next day there's six. And then the next day there's 18. And the next day you're seeing so many of them that you're like, okay, until we can get an exterminator in here, let's just go stay in a hotel. Yeah. And so we've been staying in that hotel for the last like 5,000 years.
Yeah.
Now we're ready to move back into our house, and we're ready to fumigate and get rid of this parasitic force that's taken over our home.
You might be right about the fact that this is our home. I had another ayahuasca vision, and I wrote about it, but I took it off the site. But luckily, somebody else posted it on Before It's New, so it's still there. But it was this place after going outside of the actual construct itself, And I landed on this, like, I found myself on this spaceship. I mean, that's the only way that I can describe it. And there was these three insect / spider like beings, and they were talking with a really like spider like voice. It's hard to describe.
Like such space, kind of like the great that. Spider. Yeah.
And they I saw this ball of energy, and I asked them, "What is that?" And they said, "That's your universe." And I said, "Well, why did you create it?" And they said, "We didn't create it. We just maintain it. This is the only place that souls exist. So souls have to exist in this."
Kind of like the Hadibov material, the spider race of beings.
Yes. And this was way before the Hadibov material. Yeah. And now David Icke is talking about the spiders as well. So maybe you're right. Maybe we keep thinking of ourselves in the dynamic of coming from somewhere else, but maybe we're actually, we have to exist within this construct.
Well, also remember, I think they keep trying to convince us to go out when we really need to go is in. So mm-hmm. I'm almost ready to say conclusion that, and this has come up a couple times in the show, so I'm repeating myself lately, but first time with you guys. The secret space program is the secret that there is. The secret is that there's no space. It's a program. It's someplace inside of us. And the way that we get to outer space is by going so far inside of ourselves that we're out there where anything is possible.
That is exactly right. There was a DMT experience I had that was so profound that
I was asking you to share this. Would you talk about it on the thing with Frank?
I'm going to remember this for the rest of my life.
Okay, this is it. This is how we're going to end the show. This is perfect. This is what I want.
Amazing. So, the self-transforming machine elves, I think, are a kind of almost an extension of ourselves. They are the best parts of us talking to us and trying to tell us what we already know, but we don't, like, in our conscious mind know. And so they are spinning me around and loving on me and stuff. And I said, well, you know, where's God in all this? If the God of the Bible is an asshole, which I've had my experience with him, I don't want another one. So where is the... And they said, and they lowered me onto this like platform where I was in the center, like a carousel where I'm in the center, and they're going around me and they're all saying, it's inside of you. It's inside of you. It's inside of you. But they were turning inward to themselves too. And so kind of telling me it's inside of you and us. It's inside of all of us.
Of course it is.
Okay. Of course, absolutely. And I was so funny because I was going to ask you to tell that story and you have no idea why till the end of the show, because it's the way we always end. But on that note, Randy, do you have anything else to say? I want to thank you guys. This has been an incredible conversation and you're welcome back anytime.
Dude, do I have anything else to say? Are you kidding me? Do I have anything else to say? No, I don't. The only thing I can say at this point is, Chris and Sherry, thank you for coming on. Thanks for an amazing conversation. For the listeners out there, thanks for joining us. Come back and visit us again at offplanetradio.com. And the truth is out there. It's inside you.
All right. Thanks.
Stop recording. We'll be right back.